I'd like to thank the Women's Caucus for organizing this session and providing me the opportunity to talk with you. And it's really a privilege to be included in a session that's related to issues in women's health needs. The last speaker talked about wide variations within and across states regarding insurance and cited St. Louis, Missouri. Well, it just happens I'm from St. Louis. I'm not from St. Louis. I'm from Missouri. And I'm going to be talking about a different kind of variation, the variation in the way different institutional review boards interpret their role, their responsibility, and the research project that they are ruling on. And what this has in common is it has a similar impact, and that is a negative impact on meeting the needs of women and on women's health. Let's see. And I'm somewhat challenged in dealing with the technical aspects here, so bear with me. I don't have any thing to disclose, so let's move on. I'd like to first tell you that I am both the operations director of the Missouri Cancer Registry and a research associate professor in health management and informatics at the University of Missouri, and MCR is a collaborative partnership between the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services and the University of Missouri, and you can read the how we got our funding from CDC's National Program of Cancer Registries. I'd also like to acknowledge the research project that was supported, and the title of this project is Neighborhood Impact on the Quality of Life in Breast Cancer Survivors. It's an NCI-R01 funded project with the principal investigator being at Washington University in St. Louis, and I'm the principal investigator of the subcontract located in Columbia, Missouri. I'd also like to acknowledge my co-author, Suzanne Coulter. Dr. Coulter is the project coordinator and responsible for day-to-day operations of the project, and Mario Schutman, the PI of WashU. And Dr. Schutman, well, pardon me, while sometimes astounded by the actions of the University of Missouri's Health Sciences Institutional Review Board, has remained extremely supportive through all the delays and setbacks, and just recently authored a paper using our data showing that a cluster of late-stage breast cancers occurring in the city of St. Louis, identified through use of our data, has now disappeared. And that's a tremendous accomplishment for public health because we use data, evidence-based, to have programs that were implemented by the Department of Health, by Washington University, by neighborhood health centers in St. Louis, and a variety of other organizations. And we think that this is one of the greatest uses of data that we have seen in Missouri for cancer registry data. I'd also like to acknowledge the staff of the HBRRC who conducted and supervised interviews, and the women who participated in the interviews. Women with breast cancer contacted 1 year post-diagnosis, contacted a second time 2 years post-diagnosis, and participating in, depending on whether they were 65 or older, a 35 or 45-minute interview. Sometimes the interviews ran on to over an hour because we go at the pace the woman wants to go. And sometimes women want to talk about their health and the impact their cancer has on their health or the neighborhood they live in. And that's what we're here for, is to get their opinions, their feedback, in hopes of improving their lives, and if not their lives, lives of women like them. And the women without breast cancer or any other form of cancer who served as controls. They live in the same neighborhoods. They're matched on age group and area of residence, and in the St. Louis City, St. Louis County, and Kansas City on race. The purpose of my presentation is to, I have a kind of a throg in my throat today. I want to describe the barriers we encountered in implementing this study, and I'd like to talk about how the barriers have been overcome, and I wish I could say that all the barriers have not had a negative impact on this study. Unfortunately, I can't say that, as you will discover in the next few minutes. This is the real tragedy, that measures designed to protect participants. Are you going to do that for me? Or?
I was going to.
Okay, yeah, great.
We've got a glass of water.
Okay. Hey. See, this is what talking at the Women's Caucus is all about. We help each other. The real tragedy is that measures designed to protect participants in research studies are now being implemented in ways that impede our ability to meet the needs of participants and ways that may help improve the quality of life of participants. Next. So, at the end of this presentation, I hope you'll be able to identify at least three barriers to enrolling underserved women in research studies and discuss ways to overcome these barriers and increase enrollment of target populations. This is just one research study, but the problems we encountered may be extreme, but they're not unique. In the presentation yesterday, I discussed how a session at last year's APHA meeting helped me cope with the problems on this project, and I hope the lessons that we have learned will help you as you proceed with your research projects. I'm not going to spend much time talking about why IRBs were created. Abuses and ethical violations that led to the creation of IRBs have been well documented. And researchers generally agree that IRBs and researchers must operate under a set of rules and regulations. Now, while I knew that IRBs had some latitude in interpreting regulations, until I had to deal with one of the two IRBs at my institution, there's a campus IRB, and they have behavioral and social scientists on their boards that understand the type of research we are doing. But because I'm in the School of Medicine, we had to go through the Health Sciences IRB. And because this is the first study that had been done using the data from the database of the cancer registry since it was moved to the University of Missouri, and since they're mainly involved in clinical trials and not this type of research, there was a real lack of understanding and appreciation for this type of research. And I really had no idea how broad the latitude in interpreting regulations could be. I was frankly astounded. And the latitude was so broad that I began to think that researchers who are female PhDs have no rights, when even one male MD who doesn't like or doesn't understand a research project is in a position of power on an institutional IRB. And I've been in public health for over 20 years. I've felt that in terms of promotion, but I had never felt it before in terms of the science base of a project. And I was too old to accept that easily. I had heard stories of how IRB concern for protecting subjects and inhibiting enrollment of target populations, including during a session on public health surveillance versus research and IRB creep at last year's APA conference. I had already experienced some roadblocks on this project when I heard that session, but I thought we'd overcome most of those barriers. I was dead wrong. One of my take-home messages for you is that to ensure underserved women's access to and participation in research, investigators must understand the IRB's orientation and, if necessary, educate the IRB. We were established, the registry, in 1972 when reporting was voluntary. It became mandatory in 1984. And have any of you heard of the dioxin contamination at Times Beach, Missouri? Well, that's what got the registry mandated by the state. Dioxin is a cancer-causing agent. And like many states, they mandated it, but they didn't fund it adequately. So it wasn't until we got funding from the National Program of Cancer Registries, administered by the CDC in 1995, that we had the money to do what we needed to do. And 1996 is our reference year for NPCR, and I became the first director of the registry after that. And for a decade, we focused on building a high-quality surveillance database. Since diagnosis year 1998, we've met all national standards. We only missed one for the first 2 years. And as a result of having this high quality database, we don't like to have data, you know, just set on a shelf. or just be used for public health surveillance. I mean, it's incredibly good data for public health surveillance, but the potential to really impact the lives of individuals lies in research as well. And so in 2006, we began participating in this NCI-funded research project. You can't imagine how excited we were. NCI called this a cutting-edge project. And you all know that breast cancer is one of the leading cancers among women, and it has high survival rates, particularly if diagnosed early. And we do know that there are disparities in diagnosis and treatment. But now that so many women are surviving, we need to focus not just on making sure they survive, but on their quality of life. And so we wanted to go beyond those disparities at stage of diagnosis and treatment, and if we hold those constant, look at how quality of life may be impacted by things outside the individual, by the neighborhood in which women live, and the impact of the neighborhood, their support systems, their access to care, their ability to get to post-treatment appointments, and well women checkups, their fear, the danger they feel in the neighborhood, or the lack of access to exercise facilities. So we used our database to identify subjects who would be asked to participate in two telephone interviews. And we submitted a protocol and supporting documents to the university's Health Sciences IRB. But as PI, I have to take responsibility. I didn't understand their orientation. I didn't understand their lack of knowledge about behavioral research. I assumed, all of us did, that since the NCI had approved this, Washington University's IRB had approved this as a minimal risk study, I assume they just look at it. It's already been approved by two agencies, the funding agency and the agency where the PI, main PI is. So, you know, and it's just interviews with women 1 year post-diagnosis. They have to first sign a permission to release their confidential information, then they have to sign a consent form, and then they have to sign HIPAA. So what is there? And we're just asking them questions, and they can refuse to answer any one. So what is there that's anything more than minimal risk? Well, that's where I went wrong the first time. First, they delayed the approval. They said that I was the PI, and I was also the operations director of the cancer registry, and I was wearing two hats, and I might bias the study. The only thing that salvaged that was there was a male MD who said, well, gee, I wear multiple hats. I treat patients, I do research. I consult with my colleagues' patients. I do research involving my colleagues' patients. And what's the big deal? Nobody's ever said, I can't wear multiple hats, so why should just two hats in a female PhD be inappropriate? Well, thanks. I really appreciate Clay Anderson, the supportive MD. Next thing, they changed the cover letter. Now, this cover letter had been approved by, even though it was ours, WashU's IRB had to approve it, had been approved by WashU's IRB. And we thought it explained the study, but was not neutral, or but was neutral or and not coercive. As I've already mentioned, we have this extra step that only two other states that I'm aware, New Jersey and New York, have, where you have to get permission to release confidential information before you can give information in the cancer registry to a researcher. But they made us take so much out of the cover letter that women didn't know what they were being asked to do. And so we would get calls, well, what does this mean? We have an 800 number they could call. Or once we finally got this approved, we would have to call them and find out why they hadn't said yes or no. Well, they didn't know what they were saying yes or no to. And they made us include information in the HIPAA authorization that had nothing to do with this study and was all about treatment, but there is no treatment involved in this study. So that was just confusing. But most of all, they classified it as high risk. And that meant that we had this statute that says they got to get, we have to have a signed piece of paper where they approve the release of their confidential information. We can't get around that. But if a woman returns a consent form or a HIPAA authorization unsigned or fails to return one of those forms, as a low-risk study, we could have got approval by phone. As a high-risk study, we had to have three forms approved in writing. And so what these modifications did is they inhibited enrollment. And this was particularly enrollment among older women. Well, who gets breast cancer? Majority. You're over 50. And many of them are over 65. And we did limit this to women 25 and older to maintain confidentiality because there were so few women in Missouri with breast cancer under 25 that we couldn't guarantee their confidentiality. With a two-page cover letter that doesn't say anything, a one-page formed with permission to release confidential information, a four-page consent form, and a three-page HIPAA document, you think a lot of women just said, I don't understand this, and threw it aside? So we had to call them. Now, we had won one battle. They didn't want to let us call women who didn't return the forms. They said that would be coercive. Wait a minute. And the way we got around that was we said, if you don't let us do that, that is going to bias the study against the inclusion of older women, women of color, and women with less education, and women with lower incomes. So what led to these decisions? Well, poor communication. I didn't do my homework. I didn't understand the great latitude that people on the IRB have in making decisions. And the members of the IRB, even the chair, remain unpublished at the University of Missouri. Some institutions publish it. It's not that I wanted to contact any individual because I knew I couldn't. But if I had known the composition, I could have prepared more for what they did or didn't know. There wasn't any guidance. The campus IRB had a great deal of guidance on their website about what you needed to do. The IRB, Health Sciences IRB, didn't have the same guidance. It was under construction, under development. And there were many misunderstandings. There was one male MD who just didn't understand the study and didn't like it. So what happened? Well, we had lengthy delays in getting the initial approval. They shut us down for 6 weeks when one out of 1,000 women with cancer who had been contacted called the IRB office and said she thought that it was a HIPAA violation. They admitted there was no HIPAA violation. There was no protocol violation. She got the remedy she wanted, but they still shut us down for 6 weeks. And they made a bad situation even worse in that they made us make changes to all of these forms in the middle of a study that was ongoing. Over 600 people had already been interviewed. What were our solutions? Well, we consulted these experts I've mentioned from last year's APHA. We reviewed IRB policies and procedures at the national level. We held face-to-face meetings, during one of which, in a hearing, I had this one male jab his finger in my face while he's yelling at me, "If I say harm has been done, harm has been done, and you have no recourse. Harm was not done to one woman, harm was done to hundreds of women." So, in conclusion, moving from public health to surveillance to research involving cancer patients is a learning experience for investigators and IRBs, and you've got to have clear and ongoing communication. And I hope you never encounter the problems that I had. But if you do, call me.
Thank you.